address and title, mad cow disease,
and hyper disease,
it bears us there's something extraordinarily topical about that title. But for, what was it, 9 members of Parliament, we might have had a general election on our hands this week following that vote of censure on this very issue, mad cow disease. Isn't it amazing how a veterinary problem like that could threaten to bring down a British government? Not, I suspect, and suggest, because of its veterinary content, but because of its political content. Well, this is really just a long way round talking about something which has been very evident in the last year or two, and that is how mad cow disease, how something that has occurred in the kingdom of men has almost inadvertently drawn attention to one of the great signs of our times. And I thought we might, for the benefit of those younger brethren and sisters who are not as familiar as some of us are with Bible symbology like this, take some time off to look at some of the issues involved. What prompted me was an article in the Evangelical Times last summer, the BSC disaster, is this the finger of God? Pointing out, as that newspaper does to its very devout members, that it was in 1865 that the Bishop of Liverpool, J.C. Ryle, drew the attention of the nation to the way in which he sought to establish the principle that national calamities are the judgments of God. Well, there's no doubt, brothers and sisters, that BSC has got a lot more of a calamitous nature about it than just the culling of a million or so cows and the vast indentation that makes on the British budget. It has an awful lot to do, as we've seen this week, with Britain's relationship with Europe. And it could well be one of the reasons, the underlying reasons and attitudes to it, that will formulate British attitudes to Europe in the future. But let's first of all answer that question. Is that a judgment of God upon the nation for its folly? Well, I can say quite unequivocally and with no doubt at all, possibly. By that I mean, yes, but then again, no, for this reason. We know, of course, when the Lord looked forward to AD 70, he said there would be famines and pestilences in divers places. And sure enough, we can go to Acts and elsewhere, and we can say, yes, those prophecies prior to AD 70 did in fact come to pass. But they were not just unique to that age. There were great famines and pestilences all down the age of history. The Black Death in 1348, the Great Plague of 1605, which affected the migration of so many Jews, did it not? The Great Cholera Epidemic of 1830, which took so many Irish people off to Chicago and elsewhere. Then there was the Foot and Mouth Disease Plague of 1860-65, of which we've just drawn attention. 1988. Remember all those advertisements on television saying that HIV and AIDS almost is a judgment of God upon the nations? And were we not scurrying to and from Romans and Genesis 19 saying, well, yes, I mean, it's the sin of man visiting mankind itself. And so now we have a mad cow disease. What does the Bible say? Well, I was struck by the Daily Mail had a big centre page spread last summer talking about featherless chickens, self-shearing sheep, asexual character. What on earth are we doing to nature? And my mind was drawn to the words in Revelation 11:18 that Christ is coming, we know that, brothers and sisters, to destroy them which destroy the earth. And I thought, since then, we might look at two quotations, and I've quite deliberately taken them from the NIV. Look first at Romans chapter 8, verse 19 to 21, because I think there is here commentary upon things like mad cow disease and similar disasters which have been basically brought upon mankind by his own actions. Judgment is coming, brothers and sisters, upon the earth. We proclaim that week by week, but rather, I think, a couple of insights. Romans 8, 19 to 21. Creation awaits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. For creation was subject to frustration, not by its own choice, but in hope that creation will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. And so there, I think, is quite an interesting commentary, if you like, upon the way in which creation, speaking generally, ecology, call it whatever word you like, is suffering from the folly of man. It's subject to frustration, not because creation, inanimately, as it were, chose it, but it became that way and is now waiting liberation from its bondage to decay. I think that's quite helpful. Then you turn over to those perhaps better words in Revelation chapter 11. Chapter 11, perhaps arguably one of the more difficult chapters in the Apocalypse to understand. But the message here is clear. Revelation 11, 17 and 18. Again, I've deliberately taken this from the NIV because sometimes, I'm not a great believer myself in the NIV, but sometimes it's refreshing to look at these thoughts in new language. We give thanks to you, Lord God Almighty, because you have taken your great power and have begun to reign. The nations were angry, and your wrath has come. The time has come for judging the dead, rewarding your servants and your saints, and those who reverence your name, and for destroying those who destroy the earth. And so we can have no doubt, as we proclaim the gospel about the immorality of man, the moral sins of mankind, what he has done to God's own creation is something for which, quite clearly, he's going to be held responsible. But creation, brothers and sisters, just like the men and women of our day, are looking forward to the time of liberation from those things. Well, all of that came at a time when I was wondering whether there was enough, as it were, to put together for a Sunday night testimony to the fact that the Lord is coming to destroy those who destroy the earth for their sins against God's creation, when I went into our local library, and there, lo and behold, I came across the German magazine Der Spiegel. Now, Der Spiegel is the German equivalent, really, of Time magazine. It's a thoughtful paper, a bit like, I don't know, Time magazine or The Economist. And it's featured heavily in our local library because every library now in the country, every main central library, has its European unit. And I looked at this and I thought, well, if ever I've seen a mad cow, this must be it. I don't know if you can see it. And here's the Union Jack. And this is saying Europe's million graves amongst the cattle, all because of England's cattle. And there's this mad cow with its Union Jack being ridden by a woman carrying a European flag. And suddenly it struck me, I thought to myself, well, I wonder what other people make of that. So I think tonight, really provoked by mad cow disease, as we'll see, much of this has been, we could take time off to remind ourselves of one or two biblical principles. And I think it might therefore be instructive if we just remind ourselves that in Bible prophecy, animals are often used to represent nations. Here's another point. Sometimes varying according to the state of their development. So an animal can, what's the word, metamorphose according to the state of that nation's development. Can you think of a good example? Well, the obvious one is, of course, the lion in Daniel chapter 7, which we'll look at in a moment. See, Daniel has a vision of several beasts. And the first was like a lion, but that lion had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made to stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart given to it. And so here, using some pictures drawn by a Christadelphian artist in 1883 or thereabouts, we have a representation, as we'll see in a moment, of the old Assyrian Empire that becomes the Babylonian Empire. In a way, it's much the same kind of creature, it's much the same sort of animal as that empire. But here it metamorphoses, if that's the right word, from having eagle's wings, throwing to having no wings, but standing up as a man. Well, where can we provide proof of that? It's right for me to say that is so. If you went to Assyria, and it's part of the Middle East I've not been to, you would soon discover, of course, the animals, these lion-type creatures with wings. There is a symbol of the Assyrian lion, the animal that represented the Assyrian Empire. Again, last year, my wife and I were privileged to go to Berlin, incidentally, just really to see how Gomer and Magog were getting along. But in between time, we went into the Pergamon Museum. I'm sorry, the colour just doesn't work on this projector. It's not strong enough light. But if I were to show you the reconstruction of the Astarte Gate from Babylon, along the walls here are animals all shown representing the lions of Babylon. And all I'm trying to do is say that, well, when you went to Assyria, you could see an animal that looked like that, but that nation changed and became Babylon, and so the animal metamorphosed, it changed, according to its time in history. So there is a scriptural example, but we all know, do we not, how the world today sees, rightly or wrongly, nations as animals. Not a word need be said about that picture. It says it all. Certainly, Brendan, I've got to get the maximum mileage out of that picture, because the state of Yeltsin's health, notwithstanding what Madeleine Albright said this morning, there's no doubt that here we see Yeltsin dancing to the nationalist bear. Accurate reflection of political activity. So just one or two examples then of how nations clearly are represented by animals in divine prophecy, divine history, biblical history, secular history. Well, now for our next example, I want you to turn to Daniel chapter 8. I'm going to ask once again for a reading of a portion from Daniel chapter 8, just the first seven verses, and then, to summarize it, verses 20 and 21. Daniel chapter 8.
Daniel chapter 8, verses 1 to 7. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the third. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass, when I saw, that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Ulai. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram, which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, and northward, and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. Thus he did according to his will, and became great. And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west, on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. He came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Verse 20. The ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia, and the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king.
So there, Daniel has this vision of the ram and the he-goat. And we are told explicitly, without any argument amongst us, that the goat over here represents Greece, and over here represents Persia, the ram. So we know that. But did anyone else? Well, it's an important point that the Lord is saying, when certain things happen, you will see animals come into play. And when he said that there shall be conflict between Greece and Persia, then those two animals will fight each other. Now let's get that principle clear, that the Lord is giving prophetic messages through the use of animal symbols. But was that a complete mystery to people in his day? No, I was intrigued by coming across, interestingly enough, another Bishop of Liverpool, Thomas Newton, in that ancient book, Prophecies, Minds, dated about 1823, I think, in which Thomas Newton says, talking of Daniel chapter 8, he said, a question remains as to why that empire, which was likened once for a bear, should now be represented by a ram. Mr. Mee's conjecture is ingenious and plausible enough, because the Hebrew word for a ram and the Hebrew word from Persia both spring from the same root. Perhaps, therefore, Elam in Chaldee and ram in Hebrew were synonymous. So when Daniel is talking about a vision about a ram, what's he doing? He's very blatantly, openly talking about the power of Persia. He's using the same word. For ram, read Persia. Well, now let us turn to Daniel chapter 7. What I'm trying to establish is that those would not have been completely mysterious symbols, that there was reason to believe that they meant something to people in Daniel's day. Now turn to Daniel chapter 7, and we'll read the first 8 verses.
In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven drove upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold another beast, the second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth, which devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were 3 of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in his horn were eyes, like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things.
So, if you like a visual presentation of that chapter, were those four beasts that Daniel saw in his vision. Here we have the bear, the lion again, you see, with wings, and then the Medo-Persian, the leopard comes next, and then he sees a great unnamed beast. What we ought to do is ally them back to what we already know about Daniel chapter 2 and Nebuchadnezzar's image. We're all familiar with this sort of thing. We use it at Bible exhibitions. We use it on Sunday nights to show how Nebuchadnezzar had a vision of the kingdom of men right the way down to the coming of Christ. And we're quite prepared, and any self-respecting Sunday school scholar, I think, can tell you that thou art the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar, and we come through the Medo-Persian and the Greek and the iron of the Roman Empire. When Daniel sees the kingdom of men, he sees them as beasts. Won't have time to turn off to Ecclesiastes to see the terminology, but Daniel sees in vision the nations of men portrayed as beasts. And the one that we want to look at particularly tonight is this one down here. And we're given a very good description of it in that seventh chapter, because there is the Assyrio-Babylonian lion, there is that bear representing Medo-Persia at one stage, it's subsequently represented by a different animal later on, then comes Greece, and there's terrible beast that corresponds to the time of Rome. Well, there's no alternative but to go back to Daniel chapter 7, to start reading at verse 7, and then to continue from 19 to 28. Daniel 7, introduction of verse 7, and then to switch over to verse 19.
Daniel chapter 7, verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before. Ten horns. Verse 19. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, and his nails of bronze, which devoured, brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, and of the ten horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom three fell, even of that horn that had eyes, and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints, and prevailed against them, until the ancient of days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And the ten horns out of this kingdom are ten kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue three kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws. And they shall be given into his hand, for the time and times and the dividing of times. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion, to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart.
So then, the nature of that fourth beast is described. We want to notice one or two things. There is no discussion or disagreement, I think, amongst us that, of course, that image extends from the time of Babylon right down to the time when the stone cut out of the mountain without hands will smite the image upon its feet. In other words, the kingdom of God. We're quite happy to say that. Of course, it makes the legs a little bit extended, isn't it? Those legs become almost 2,000 years long, if you could measure legs by years. But nonetheless, in the last days, there must be something to do with the iron of Rome, because certainly the kingdom of God has not yet been established on earth. Well, similarly, that fourth beast starts around the time of Rome and is going to be around in the last days when the Ancient of Days comes and when the saints are called upon to destroy it. So it really is a most peculiar animal. In fact, I do just wonder whether we're right to even try to portray it, because Daniel couldn't put a name to it, not that he'd run out of zoological terminology, but he was faced with a very difficult task, trying to persuade him that that fourth beast provides a historic link from the Greek Empire down to the kingdom of God. It came on after the beast representing Greece. The kingdom of men are represented by animals. We've already proved that, I hope. Well, this is a Roman beast, and that fourth beast represents various phases of Rome. And when you're talking about that power, remember we said with the Assyrian, it metamorphosed from having wings through to standing up like a man? Well, this fourth beast takes upon itself various symbols, which we read about in the Bible. A great red dragon, a beast of the sea, beast of the earth, scarlet-coloured beast, harlot riding on a beast, call it what you like. You know, but that beast is there to be destroyed by Christ and the saints. And here's the problem. You try talking to some young people and getting that idea across. I spent a long time thinking about how do you do it. Do you really want me to believe that that beast takes on all those forms? For brothers and sisters, I see we've got one or two youngsters in the audience. Miriam, do you do nature study at school? You do? How would you describe that? Caterpillar? Are we all agreed? Caterpillar? What does a caterpillar, what happens to it? It what? Turns into a butterfly. Do you want me to believe that creepy crawly turns into a butterfly? I mean, is that a fact? Did you? Anyone believe that? You all do. You all believe it. Well, it is interesting, isn't it? That you're prepared to believe that a caterpillar will turn into a beautiful, beautiful butterfly. And not just one butterfly, but a caterpillar looking like that can have brown wings or blue wings or be spotted. Beautiful. And yet we're prepared to believe it because we know that is what happens. I'd like to tell you something else. How long does it take, do you know, Miriam, for the chrysalis to break out into a butterfly? Well, I went to the kiddie section of our local library and I found out, giving myself a little lesson in nature study myself. But here's a point. Here are some photographs, I don't know what you call them, stop motion or something, with a clock against them. And it shows how that thing there, that Miriam wants me to believe is going to become a butterfly, sure enough, 12, 5 past 12, 10 past 12, by 20 past 12, it's broken out and become a butterfly. Now, brothers and sisters, there is no difficulty in our accepting that that very unattractive, almost indescribably sluggy, awful caterpillar becomes something very beautiful over a measurable period of time. Right? So let us then accept that when the Lord uses his symbology, he takes a beast that Daniel couldn't describe. It was so terrible. Oh, awful. It terrified him. And yet that beast will metamorphose over a period of time. And that period of time was in fact given to us in that chapter. I don't know if you noticed it. But we won't divert to that. So when we follow the history of that creature, we come to the 13th chapter of Revelation and we find, lo and behold, that beast that could not be described and therefore probably ought not to have been even drawn by us, turns up in the 13th chapter of Revelation, and do look at the words of that chapter. John stands upon the sand of the sea, and he sees a beast rise up from the sea, the nations of men, if you like, around the Mediterranean. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, the feet were the feet of a bear, his mouth is the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him power. And so there are all sorts of reminders of the nations of men at work. Well, that is just a representation of that beast. It's metamorphosed now from being something indescribable, we therefore probably shouldn't even have shown you, into a beast of the sea. Well, we're not here to try and attempt an exposition of Revelation tonight, but the beast of the sea, brothers and sisters, came to represent a group of nations in Europe which had originated from the western leg of the Roman Empire. Go back to that empire. Now, let's switch off there. Anyone into mythology? Greek mythology? Now, having been off sick this week, I did something which I never do, watch television. Oh my, isn't it dreadful? But on Tuesday night, by coincidence, did you see the John Romer programme on the ancient wonders of the world? Golly, am I the only one who has BBC Two? But let's divert for a moment, if you don't mind. Cue up everything that you know so far, that the Lord has given those symbols to teach us something, that they have to be intelligible to us. Let's spend a minute or two on Greek mythology, because this is what John Romer did, and I was particularly interested because, as I'll show you in a moment, he went to where we had been on holiday a little while earlier. One of the things about Greek mythology, cut long story short, is that it incorporates many ideas from earlier mythologies. So the mythologies of Greece stem in part from Egypt, from Babylon, and pass on to Rome, so that the Greek gods turn up in Rome, same gods, but with different names. And so the great god Baal, it has been said, is represented in Greek mythology by Zeus. And of course, the temple of Zeus was one of the great wonders of the world. It's where the Olympic Games started. You remember, it's all topical stuff. If you go to Olympia in the Peloponnese, go to where the temple of Zeus stands, it's worth just to take a minute or two off to contemplate the huge size of that. Now, there's an interesting point that John Romer made. If you go into some of those temples in Greece and Turkey and you look at the representations of the apostles in is there an expert on Byzantine art? No, you're not. Anyone else? Right, well, I'm safe. I am told, and I've certainly seen this sort of thing, that if you walk into a Greek church, you know it's St. Peter, because he's the one who's got curly hair, slightly blonde and gingery sort of long beard. And that's always St. Peter. And St. Paul, as they call him, is always a very, very Jewish-looking gentleman with black hair and a very bald dome, and that is always St. Paul. And Christ, in the middle, and I've seen this certainly in Istanbul, has the same face as Zeus. Now, it's worth going to the library, and I intend to do this next week, just get a hold of some pictures and see if we can trace the fact that what the apostate church has done has actually used a picture of the great god, Greek god Zeus, and brought it into Byzantine art. But be that as it may, I've got to tell you a story about Zeus. He's known, of course, in Roman times as Jupiter. But Zeus was king of the Grecian gods, and he was born in Crete. Anyone going to Crete for the holidays knows that one of the standard tourist packages is to go to the cave and see where Zeus was born, and if you believe that, of course, you believe anything. Zeus, however, one day sets out and visits Tyre. But he has this remarkable ability to disguise himself as a bull. Now, stop there for a moment, brothers and sisters. What is that saying? That god manifests himself in different ways. Well, what does Yahweh, the God of Israel, do? He manifests himself in different ways. So this is just a pagan or mythological copying, a sick copy of what it has learned about a Jewish religion. Anyhow, Zeus goes out, this guy, Zebul, and there on the beach at Tyre, he meets the daughter, Princess Europa, the daughter of King Agenor of Tyre, centre of Baal worship. And so he proceeds to seduce her, and he says, okay, I'll come with you. And she rides on his back to Crete. And there, when she gets back to Crete, bears him three sons, one of whom is Minos, who builds Knossos, and the founder of the Minoan civilization. All of which, of course, was the subject to archaeological discoveries earlier this century in Crete, and where you can go today, the number one tourist place in Crete is to go to the palace of Knossos, the palace of Minos, the son of the illicit relationship between the daughter of the king of Tyre and the king of the Grecian gods. And anyone who's been there knows how you can risk breaking your neck trying to take a photograph of the way in which the bull-type characters are represented. And so the bull is very much the mascot. It's in the museum at Heraklion. You see them all over the place. It's very much a symbol of Minoan civilization. Well, that story about Europa being seduced by the bull, or King Zeus, the pagan religion, was, funnily enough, memorialized in Italian art, or Roman art. If you look in the Encyclopedia Britannica, lo and behold, there you will find a representation of the things whereof we speak. And so it's quite a true legend, if there is such a thing. It's quite a well-established legend. This is where the Minoan civilization came from, and Europa, that was her name, came to be symbolized by the adventure of being seduced by a pagan religion. Which makes it all the more interesting that when the British Post Office should have wanted to commemorate the second European election to the second European Parliament, it should have chosen to represent the affairs of Europe by recalling the story that we've just told you of how Zeus seduces Princess Europa. If you ring up the British Post Office or the Philatelic Department or whatever it is, they will tell you that, well, why shouldn't we do so? After all, it's a symbol of Europe. I said, what? You mean this woman riding on this ugly creature here? Oh, yes, she says, that's the Europa, you know, riding upon Zeus. I tried not to let her know that I already knew that. But that's the story you're given, Benson. So why should the British Post Office want to do it? And why, when the European movement should want to celebrate 21 years of the European movement, should it present some or produce some ceremonial coins to mark the event, 21 ekus, use a woman riding on a beast? Wouldn't you have thought there might have been other things that could have been used instead? And talking of money, I've just seen in the paper today, I think it is, Midland Bank have come out with a new logo. If you've seen it, you know, I don't know what it means, but Midland Bank is so dreadful, I'm not surprised they needed it. But, you know, banks have logos, don't they? Do you know the one for the Bank of Europe? Why should the Bank of Europe have chosen the symbol of a beast down here with the circle of stars, brothers and sisters? You would have thought, wouldn't you, that there could have been many other ways of representing financial power in Europe. But no, that's the way things go. And so then, when a cartoonist wants to represent Europe today, he thinks that maybe Zeus had got one or two good ideas. And there is an interesting cartoon by Garland, and I think that would be The Independent, wouldn't it? Of the days when Maggie Thatcher was fighting Europe over the question of the budget. You remember how she got, in the end she resigned. Remember the day she swung her handbag in the Houses of Parliament and said no, no, no to Europe. Dramatic stuff. But it's very interesting that that woman is not riding the beast. But that's perhaps incidental. So that was 5 years ago. Well, come mad cow disease. And isn't it interesting how cartoonists who probably have never read Daniel chapter 7 or Revelation 13, 16 and 17 should choose to recall how Europe rode upon Zeus, the rape of Europa. And incidentally, that was in the, I think that's again The Independent, Ring of Stars. Got to have some decoration, I suppose, upon her dress. But it's interesting how cartoonists, and I'm quite certain Garland would never have read Elpis Israel or any Christadelphian booklet. But nonetheless, brothers and sisters, that means a lot to the man in the street. And so we have to conclude that when the Lord in AD 96, when God told us what to expect in Europe in the late 1990s, he did so with a symbol of a woman riding on a police. Now, what I'm saying is only what we said about Assyria. When the Lord wanted his followers then to know that his power was at work in the kingdom of men, he said, I'm going to send you a symbol. And you go to Assyria and you can see those lions. Go to Babylon and you know. In fact, on every packet of dates in Tesco until the Gulf War, there was that Babylonian lion on a packet of dates from Iraq. We showed that when Daniel foresaw the conflict between Greek and Persia, it was thinly veiled, wasn't it? There was a conflict which, if people had bothered to understand the signs of the times, they could have seen happening. And so we just have to remind ourselves, of course, that in the Bible a woman represents the church. 2 Corinthians 11, you don't need me to tell you how a true, faithful church is referred to as the virgin bride of Christ. We wait the time of the bridegroom's coming. The unfaithful, apostate church becomes a scarlet woman or a harlot. So the Lord is saying, now look, this is how you can know that you're in the last days, when you see these signs. And it is my belief that what God has given us is the key to what we see on television, in the papers. Here is a symbol that he is saying to us, you will recognize in the last days. Now, I'm quite sure that those who produce Time magazine have not read Revelation 13, 16, 17, 18. But why then should they choose, on this multinational magazine, choose to symbolize Europe by a woman riding on a beast with the circle of stars? And as I always point out on this slide, anyone there see the Union Jack? No, because the Union Jack ain't going to be part of Europe. Der Spiegel. See it in context. These publications, the media, are saying to us, it suits our purpose to adopt this symbol. And those who have read what the Lord has provided there, who understand the signs of the times, can look and say, yea, verily, we are in the days of Revelation 17, are we not? Did this mean anything to John? Did this mean anything to the early burn sisters? Well, we've just been doing a study of Revelation in our Bible class, and it was down to me to go all the way through Revelation 6, the seals. Undoubtedly, it seems to me that the early brothers and sisters had a sign for their time, for their generation. Why do I say that? Well, again, much as we like the sunshine on holiday, we like to go around to some of the archaeological sites. You can't see this, I'm sorry about that. Principal archaeological site on the Greek holiday island of Kos, where I believe the Apostle Paul went to. Acts 21, is it? He went to Kos, doing his trip around the Aegean Islands. There's a mosaic from the Roman villa showing Europa riding upon Zeus. Now, it's a poor photograph because it's all protected from the sunlight. You can probably make up this somewhat unclothed lady here and the creature there. Not very good, but it's there, brothers and sisters. Difficult, very difficult to photograph in Kos. Last year we were in the Greek island of Naxos and went into the archaeological museum to escape from the heat, and there tripped over a mosaic floor from a Roman villa of about BC 200 on the Greek island of Naxos, not so very far from Patmos. A day's sailing and you're in Patmos. And what was on the floor of that Roman villa? Why, the Romans knew all about a woman riding upon the beast. It was a symbol which they recognized. So why then did the John, in writing Revelation, take hold of a symbol which was clearly identifiable with Rome and say, look, to the believers, when you see these things in the last days, it'll be a manifestation of that iron power of Rome. Well, I think my wife and I must have wasted a lot of money, because last week, week before last, we were on grandparent duty, and you know what grandchildren can be like. Our grandson's just into Romans, you know, he's about five. Nothing he doesn't know about the Romans. So we thought, well, we'd better take him out to the old Roman villa at Lullingstone, which is in Kent, you know, between us and Sevenoaks. I've never been there before, but I thought for the sake of his education, never mind mine, better take young Mark there. And brothers and sisters, you go round this Roman villa, built in AD 70, which lasted until AD 495. There on my own doorstep was the mosaic inside the best preserved Roman villa in England. Do you see it? That was the time that was built. And that mosaic was laid at the time that John was in Patmos saying, now, I've got to find a symbol that connects to what Romans know today with the last day. And I think it's just absolutely incredible that right here on our own doorstep, we can see the same sort of thing that Daniel had. Persia, the ram, the word meant the same. The Assyrian, with its wings, you could see it almost on every building in Assyria. And so all we are saying is that in the last days there will be the manifestation of that symbol of the old Roman power, that Roman beast that metamorphosed over the years. And so we come right to the days in which we live. For God hath put it into their hearts, the hearts of the leaders of men, to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. You see, we're living, are we not, in the days of a united Europe, brothers and sisters? The idea of a united Europe is not new. After all, the Romans tried it nearly 2,000 years ago. Charlemagne had a go. So important is that, that the Deutsche Bank in Frankfurt used Charlemagne on their ceremonial coinage and so on. There were the German kings Otto. If you go to Aachen, you can go and see where they were crowned. The Habsburg. Did you see Count Otto von Habsburg on the television commenting upon the stupid British and the British cow disease he did, Peter? He's on television. A man who was, and they introduced him, didn't they, saying, grandson of the former emperor of Europe, or words to that effect. Napoleon, too. Bismarck and Kaiser, who, another name for Caesar, and Adolf Hitler, they've all had a go at unifying Europe. But what's new? Well, brothers and sisters, what's new is right there in Revelation 17. For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and to give their kingdom unto this beast which represents the power of Europe until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Brothers and sisters, we don't have time to do any more than say, where did you hear about kings of the earth in the last days? Well, it takes you back to Psalm 2, doesn't it? The situation that prevails after the return of Christ, when the kings of the earth will take counsel together and say, we're not going to have this man Christ. We're not going to have this power that we're going to call Antichrist, but in fact, the risen Lord, successful in Armageddon, overcoming the power out of the north, he then turns to the kings of the earth and calls upon them to yield to him. But will the powers of Europe? Oh no, not readily. And so I must just get this in, because you're going to pass a lot of these flags on the way home tonight on the motorway, I think. Look out for them. Is the European flag the banner of the beast? Is that European flag the banner of that beast of the European powers? The flag of the kings of the earth who take counsel together? Why, yes, it is. It's a subject which we haven't time to get into, but triumphantly, and forgive me, please, I'm only human, I was desperate to find out the origin of that, because you know where it comes from. Revelation 12. Do you want to just have a quick look? And Revelation 12, verse 1, there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And if we had time, you look on through that chapter, and that is a chapter that has to do with the overcoming of pagan Rome that we've been talking about tonight. So pagan Rome is overcome, and then the power of false Christianity emerges in the time of Constantine. And so you read there about the woman with the crown of 12 stars. So I thought, well, I wonder where that comes from. I know what we mean by it. That's a picture of the harlot daughters of Rome, this apostate church. Don't matter what you want to call it. This is a picture of false Christianity, isn't it? And that's the way we understand Revelation. But now you ring up a good Catholic enthusiast, and he'll say, no, you got it all wrong. That's a picture of the Virgin Mary, supported by the 12 apostles. That's the 12 stars around her. And I said, oh, yeah? He said, oh, yes, it's commemorated, you know, in Strasbourg. Strasbourg, you do know, is the capital of Europe, isn't it? Not Brussels. Strasbourg is the political home of the parliament. And there, in Strasbourg Cathedral, they have a picture of Revelation 12, verse 1. Well, I had to work extremely hard, and I'm now going to try something which I don't think will work. But I wrote to the abbot or the friar or whoever it is who runs cathedrals. I don't know what his job title is. And I said, excuse me, could I have a picture of the Window of Europe dedicated in 1986 to the Virgin Mary as the Madonna of Europe? And he sent me back the best he could do. And, it does work, very nearly. Taking photographs of stained glass windows is not an easy thing to do. But he sent me back this copy. And there, brothers and sisters, is the Virgin Mary, the Mother of Europe, the Madonna. And there is the Ring of 12 Stars. And if you say, where does that chuck in front of you with a blue flag where the Ring of 12 Stars come from? He won't know. But I'm telling you, it is inspired by the window in Strasbourg Cathedral. And so we could go on, but we're on overtime and I must finish there. Brothers and sisters, all I'm trying to say is that as with Assyria, as with Babylon, as with Medo-Persia, as with Greece, the Lord gave to those who bothered to study the signs of the times encouragement for their day. And what we are seeing now with a woman on the beast, provoked by all this turmoil over mad cow disease, is a symbol for our times. Let us then respond to the sign which the Lord has provided of the nearness of his coming.